Blog Talk Radio.
General Quarters, Security Condition 3.
GQ, Security 3, sir. General Quarters 3, intruder alert. GQ 3, intruder alert.
Mr. Sulu, how many times do I have to tell you it's not an intruder, it's our guest for the evening? Hi, this is Jennifer, or Madam Perry. Welcome you to Madam Perry Salon once again. Now, some of you know this, but if you're new, Madam Perry Salon began as a written blog about 5 or 6 years ago, and I wanted it to have the feel of a European or the British or the Asian literary cultural salons of centuries past. So we have conversations, and sometimes people call in or message in questions to give more of a conversational feel to the artists, authors who we speak with on the show. And then I had the chance to make it into a podcast, which is even cooler because sometimes you get to actually hear the voice that you've been reading or listening to or someone of whom you are a fan, and even call in and send messages. So tonight, let me say that tonight's guest is someone I met at Book Expo America 2 years ago. And just when the moment I saw her, she was, if you're looking at the image there, the montage that I made on the page on Facebook, she's wearing that gorgeous black outfit and sitting in the regal chair. And that's exactly when I first saw her, and then went to and spoke with her, made photographs, and she was very, very warm and said, "Oh, I'm doing a panel. Come and listen to it." And it was our guest, Liana Renee Heber. Liana, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to be here.
Well, I'm glad. I'm glad you're here. I don't know, and just come in here, just be comfortable. I know that you don't just write, you actually live and write and breathe the Gothic lifestyle. And here in Madam Perry Salon, I think it looks a little bit more like Jeannie's bottle, people have told me. But,
well, that's all right. I can bring my black Victorian morning into any setting. It's just fine. I am undeterred. I might not wear color, but it does not disturb me when it's around me.
Well, they're rich jewel tone colors. So, yes, please, hope you just be comfortable. And for the audience, I have to say that Liana's on a book deadline right now. So we only have her with just about a half hour. But then when she's caught up on that, when everything is turned into a publisher tour, then we'll get to have her back sometime for an entire hour. Is that right?
Absolutely, yes. I will definitely come back to you, and gladly.
Oh, good. Now, do you remember, I don't know if you remember when we met, it was at Book Expo, I think.
I do remember. The whirlwind, Book Expo is always such a whirlwind of people, and I meet so many wonderful people. And, you know, there's always the hope and the positivity and the hope that you're going to meet back up with people or follow through on blogs or interviews or any other such thing. And I'm really glad that we could follow up with this because the book community of literary minds is, as we were just saying before the show started, the authors and people interested in books, it's a wonderful community. And so I'm really excited when we can continue to make connections and come together and talk about the things that make us tick and the things that make us come back to the page time and again,
yeah,
whether we're writing or reading.
Yes, so very true. And you, after that, it was your panel, I think, was on the women in steampunk. Or
yes.
Help me out. Okay. And, you know, you were so gracious to me. You didn't even know me. And then we were just talking. Then I went to your panel. And then sometime after that, you know, you read a passage from Jim Musgrave's book, Forevermore, for us, for his YouTube channel. So I love the synchronicity.
Absolutely, absolutely. It was, you know, it's. I love the chance to read out loud, which is as a background, with a background in theater, classical theater, as I have, any chance that I get to read aloud from work, whether it's mine or someone else's, it's always a treat.
Well, let me, since I've only got a short amount of time with you, and gosh, and it's a precious amount of time, I'm not sure where to begin, but maybe we should talk about the Eternophile. This is a gas, this is a new, as I understand, gas lamp or gaslight fantasy saga.
Exactly. And the reason why we categorize it as gaslamp fantasy is that it's differentiated from steampunk in that I'm not dealing with technological devices or gadgets when my characters are coming up with solutions to their problems. They're dealing with it in a very fantasy-based and paranormal-based problem-solving. So for my characters, they're not confronted with the scientific so much as the magical and the fantastical. And I very much come from a fantasy background in terms of that. That's how I see the world, is through the eyes of the paranormal and the fantastical. I love science fiction. I love reading it. I love seeing, I mean, you know, you opened in with Star Trek, which is, you know, one of my favorite franchises. I'm a huge, huge Star Trek fan. So I love science fiction, but it's not the way that my mind, my creative process doesn't flow towards the scientific. It flows towards the wildly imaginative. In fact, that was one of the Romantic Times gave me, the RT Book Reviews gave me a review that said that it was wildly imaginative, my books, the Eternophiles. So I really kind of have free rein to sort of do whatever I want. Now you have to still adhere to a magical system, and it has to make sense and it has to be consistent. You have to do just as much world building on a fantasy as you do on a science fiction, but it's just different. I myself am interested in a very, very personal magical system that has to do with the personal gifts that each one of my characters brings into the series. So with Gaslamp Fantasy, Tor has been really, as a publishing house, has tried to distinguish steampunk and gaslamp fantasy, still appealing to those who love the Victorian aesthetic. But if you're looking for airships and gadgetry, I'm not going to be your cup of tea for this particular, you know, if you're looking for that itch to be scratched in your reading. That's not necessarily what I have. I think sometimes we can subgenre things to death, but I also think it's sometimes good because readers, when they want a particular cup of tea, they want a particular cup of tea. So my cup of tea is for the gothic and the wildly imaginative, fantastical cup of tea. So, and I keep going back to that time and again because I think that works the best for these very loose, you know, pseudosciences that the Victorians were involved in. They were hosting seances, and they sort of had their own sort of science to it, but it was really hardly science. It really was more magic tricks.
Oh, yeah, cause that is a part, I think, that sometimes gets forgotten. I think, and that also wasn't spiritualism somewhat of a practice among a lot of people. I know Sir Arthur Conan Doyle was a spiritualist.
It's interesting, the whole thing between London and New York that was happening. Upstate New York is where spiritualism first gained ground with the Fox sisters in the mid-1800s. And then it became sort of an export over to England and sort of became sensationalized over in England. And what I do believe started as legitimate gifts. Now, whether the Fox sisters themselves were as talented of a spirit mediums as they sort of claimed, they went back and forth. They sort of canted and recanted about whether they really could talk to the dead or not. What I do think is that they were actually gifted psychics that got a little bit too big for their britches in terms of their fame, and then they had to sort of perform on command. And when you start to monetize and when you start to sort of become a show about your gifts, that's when you know, from talking to those who are psychically inclined and who are gifted, that's kind of when your gifts become a little bit more suspect, because you're having to turn them on command, and the true gifts don't necessarily work exactly that way. And so I think by the time you get to, you know, England picking up on spiritualism, there was a lot of magicians that were using it as a way to put on lavish shows and also take advantage of the grieving for all of the amazing advances of the Industrial Revolution. There were still mass plagues and deaths from cholera, from tuberculosis, from yellow fever, from all these various things that, for all the advancements that had happened in this, you know, wildly productive era, the cure for death could not be, was not among them. And I think this grieved the 19th century populace that was so interested in kind of defeating nature in so many different ways. So you have this disconnect between a populace who still kind of can't deal with death and has a very strong connection to lots of loved ones dying, whether in childbirth, whether in America in the Civil War, in other, you know, campaigns in English expansion of colonialism. There's all of these kind of darker sides to it that was playing into why spiritualism was so popular. And it kind of had resurgences through the decades for the whole of the 19th century. And Conan Doyle wanted to really believe as spiritualist, but there was a period of time where he teamed up with Houdini, and this is a true thing. You can actually find the books that he wrote with Houdini debunking the spiritualists who are basically putting on magic shows, because Houdini wanted to believe as well that there was an afterlife, but he didn't want people to be taken advantage of. When you went to a show that Houdini was putting on, you knew he was a magician. You knew somewhere in there that the acts weren't actually real, and he was presenting that he was a magician. The spiritualists were passing themselves off as always real, when sometimes they were just doing stagecraft. And he took it great umbrage to that. And so him and Conan Doyle debunked a lot of them in their day. So it's this kind of push and pull between the desire to believe in these things. And I do happen to be a believer. I do happen to understand. I do happen to have psychically gifted friends in my world. And I do happen to have my own various psychic experiences. But I'm also enough of a skeptic to know that you have to kind of approach everything with a bit of a skeptic's eye. So I do that with my characters for certain. I have skeptics and I have believers, and they have to work side by side as my two teams try to find a cure for death. That's the background of Eternophiles. So the background of Eternophiles is completely steeped in what the Victorians were interested in, what they were obsessed with. And it's their obsessions that have driven my obsessions, because I fell in love with the era when I was a child and I first read Edgar Allan Poe, and I haven't looked back.
Sounds like you. In fact, I think I played a, and I might have posted it here as well, I played a short video of you being interviewed by someone from USA Today.
Yes.
And
yes,
what you
that
said.
Yeah, put it in my young adult series, yes.
Yeah, you said as soon as you read Poe, that was it. I think you had found your home, actually, essentially.
That was it. That's exactly right. It's exactly right. I'm actually, I know you can't see me, but I'm actually wearing a his portrait around my neck. I make jewelry as well, and so one of my when I hit a writer's block, I need to work with my hands. So I've begun making jewelry, and I have an Etsy store, and I have lots of images of Poe on my Etsy store, because I kind of consider him my patron saint. So in some ways, I'm making little icons, like religious icons of my patron saint Poe. Because if I hadn't have found him as a child, I really don't think I would have been a writer, and I also don't think I would have found a kindred spirit. I was just one of those kids who was born with a bit of a dark side, with a bit of a melancholic side like Poe, and I just, that finding a kindred spirit like that is really important, because that's how you that's how you can keep it in check, because those melancholies can get away with you if you don't have an outlet for them, which is what writing proved for me.
And interestingly enough, yes, I'm glad you brought that up, because I was looking at your Etsy store. I believe it's called, is it Torch and Arrow?
Torch and Arrow, yes.
And all the beautiful work that you make, and yeah, I saw the Poe work. And it's like, yeah, it's like, is that a talisman or a patron saint?
Exactly.
It's
exactly.
To carry like a charm, and charm in the most beautiful sense of the word, to carry with you. And so, yeah, I keep thinking, okay, how do you I'm not really sure how you do everything. I mean, you make beautiful artwork and the jewelry and the ribbons, and you're a playwright, and you're an author, and you are an actual, honest-to-goodness, working, card-carrying, union card-carrying actress in New York City.
I am. To tell you the truth, I honestly don't really know how I do it either. I was one of those people born with a great deal of energy, and the only way to expend all of that energy in any kind of healthy manner is to stay really, really, really busy. And so I always have. And I've sort of had several careers that kind of, you know, I've had a time where being a playwright was more at the top of my docket. I've had time where being a classical actress was more at the top of my docket. So there's things that I do and things that I have on my resume that, you know, I hit the ground running the moment I graduated college. I had an internship with the Cincinnati Shakespeare Company, and I was working, you know, immediately outside of college. I was working, you know, through my educational years, too, as a working actress. And it gave me a wonderful groundwork for the rest of my storytelling. And the theatrical work has had to take a bit of a backseat to being a novelist at the forefront. But, you know, these days it's hard. I mean, unless you're J.K. Rowling or Stephen King or, you know, and have a particular, you know, real breakaway hit on your hands, it's hard to be a working working author only without having some other things that supplement your income along the way. And so I'm kind of blessed, though, that I live in New York City and I make my living entirely from the arts, which is no small feat in a very expensive city where art and in a country where art and being an artist in some ways is very much considered a luxury. And artists have a hard time getting paid and taken seriously for their art in a lot of ways. And that's something that we as an artistic community struggle with a lot, is trying to get, you know, patrons, trying to get people to really buy our books. And that's how we quite truly survive and live. So I can't just rely on one of my artistic disciplines. I really have to rely on all of them and go kind of seasonally from one to the other, take the work when it comes, because sometimes it's a bit feast or famine, and also in between deadlines. You know, there's going to be times when I'm going to be on book deadline, and when I'm on book deadline, just nearly everything else goes away, except for, you know, taking a break to talk to you fine folks. Because, well, I mean, honestly, too, that we can't, as authors, we also can't be just in our own little world there and not also out there in the world talking about the work. I mean, we, as authors, we're tasked more and more and more in this day and age to be our own promotional tools as well as writers. So I have all kinds of irons in the fire, and it keeps me out of trouble, and it keeps me working, and it keeps me fed. So,
yeah, speaking of some of those irons you have. Oh, another thing, talking about money, like I remember when you said something like when, and just for the record, I mean, it wasn't a princely sum, but when you did the reading for Jan Musgrave for Forevermore, and then I remember you sent back this very nice but email with a little surprise, like, oh, thank you for paying so quickly. You know, and it wasn't a princely sum. I'm aware of that. However, you know, it was like that surprise, and I thought, well, you know, you want to treat somebody in the arts the way you want to be treated. And as a jazz singer and band leader for so long, I know what it's like to get there in the club.
Oh, you know.
Oh, did we
you
say
know.
That we were going to pay you what? Go, no.
Yeah.
I got some musicians here, and if I send them home without the money that I promised them, you know, their significant others may not let them out again to play with me. And also, you just want to treat. Oh, that, then there's the thing of like, well, it's a good exposure, which I always say this, Liana, exposure, is that something that you can die from or get arrested for?
Exactly. You know? That's exposure doesn't pay the rent. And I think that's the more people that we allow to understand that artists are working people just like anyone else. You know, you wouldn't go out and, you know, you wouldn't be an accountant and just, you know, go out and just do people's taxes in hopes that somebody else is going to refer you. You know, like you're going to, I mean,
right.
You know, you know, you don't, it's just, it is transactional like anything else. And I think so many freelancers, and this is just freelancers in general, we're always chasing down paychecks. And so when somebody turns something around to you, it's like you're very, very grateful, because I spend a great deal of my time, you know, chasing down proverbial paychecks here and there. I belong to the Freelancers Union, as well as my, you know, SAG and AFTRA, the actors unions. And the Freelancers Union statistic the other day I saw in an email was like 81% of freelancers either are always late being paid or never get paid at all, and then they have to take escalatory measures. And I thought, my goodness, 81%, that's just insane. And I think part of that is because we there's a whole sector of our economy, and freelancers are not getting respected, but there's so much of our economy that's based on freelancing, because everyone's having to work harder than ever to make ends meet.
No kidding,
and that's
everyone.
Across all fields, it's not just the arts, but the arts have it the worst, because we're always kind of the last rung on the totem pole in some ways.
And speaking of working everywhere, then you saw I put on the page here, it says that you work in film and TV. One of the shows you've worked on is Boardwalk Empire, and I had a photo of you from that on the montage here.
Oh, good.
And you're also
Tell us about your experience. That show was it's the only show that I've worked. I've been working, you know, in the industry in New York here for 10 years. I moved to New York when I joined Actors Equity, which is the Stage Actors Union, and I moved to New York with that under my belt, because the unions are a really good resource for actors when you come here. I bounced around the regional theater circuit before that, and when I got here and because of my standing in Actors Equity, I was able to join SAG as a sister union, because I'd gotten an equity contract under a principal role. So I'd had a leading role, and then this allowed me to join the other unions under that same principal. So I've been, you know, working just background and featured roles in various shows, because I could still go into those calls, because when you're a featured background actor, they want you to have acting training, but you don't necessarily have to audition, because it's more about they just need you to act enough to have something in the setting, in the background of the scene or the foreground of the scene, but they're not going to audition you like an under five or a day player where you have lines. I don't have time to audition day in and day out and write my books and do the other things. So I had to sort of make a choice and say, okay, I'm going to actually kind of demote myself in terms of an acting, going down to just background work and extra work, and not go after the actual day player or the leading roles, because I don't have time for the audition process. But I still wanted to stay involved, and I still wanted to be on screen one way or another. So thankfully, you know, a good acting background allowed me to kind of be able to be featured in several different things that, you know, casting directors who might have worked with me on one show and knew I was reliable and knew I would show up and knew that I wouldn't pester the stars. I mean, that's, you know, that's half the battle,
right,
is just
right.
Being somebody that you can work with and being professional. I worked every single season of Boardwalk Empire. It was 5 seasons. I worked every single season, and it was delightful, because the attention to historical detail. I would come in at the beginning of the season, because I have a look that is good for period things. Everyone, when I'm all dressed in all my regalia, everyone says that I look like I am from another era. And I think that's part of my sense of belonging in these historical time periods. I have this affinity with these elder eras. And so for Boardwalk, I'd come in at the beginning of the season, they'd fit me in an outfit, and then I would wear that outfit once a month and basically just be walking around in the background or perhaps featured in various scenes. There's two different episodes I'm very visible in, the most significant of which is season 4, episode 2, the very, very top of the show. Michael Shannon's character is giving flowers out to people. That's his sort of undercover way in which he's working with the mob. And he gives me flowers and a gentleman who's grieving flowers, and then the third person opens the door and he punches them in the face. So we're an elaborate setup for the joke, the three people. So I lead off the episode by being the woman at the door with the baby who gets the flowers from that character. And so it was an all-day shoot, and it was great, and it was neat because they used that for the teaser for the show that week, and you know, those kinds of things are really fun because you actually do get to act. It's more than just doing a background thing where you walk behind the screen, you know. But it was lovely in that I got a chance to really be, you know, there and participatory in the show. And everyone working on that set was so magnificently attuned to period detail. It was beautiful. All the costumes were exquisite, and the effects were amazing. I got to be a part of the scene where they blew up one of the clubs, and there was all these pyrotechnic effects, and they had this big explosion in Brooklyn, and they had to make sure that everyone in Brooklyn knew that this was a legitimate, like, this was not like a terrorist attack. This was actually just Boardwalk Empire on the set, you know, blowing up a building. Don't worry, it's all, you know. So it's just those kinds of things are really kind of fun. That's the stuff about working in television. It's like, you know, getting a chance to watch an actual, you know, stunt car crash like I did when I worked the Adjustment Bureau film, like, things like that. So,
yeah,
you know, that,
yeah, exactly.
Stuff is awesome.
Yeah, well, the same thing, you know, we've seemed to have had a revival lately of TV shows and movies in Atlanta, too. So it's just sort of like, you know, people are like, what's going on? Oh, it's probably Vampire Diaries or something, you know. But yeah, it's another show. So, I mean, we love it. We're proud of it. You know, but yeah, you sort of take it in stride.
Oh,
like
okay. Oh, it's so funny because totally. And in Atlanta too, because I mean, I go to Atlanta every year for Dragon Con. So I'm there every year. And so we'll have to meet up next Dragon Con.
Definitely.
And
but
whenever I'm in Atlanta and it's dark, or if it's quiet, you know, if it's not Dragon Con, if I've been there, then I always, of course, just assume it's Walking Dead. So I just, anywhere I look, you know, I just assume something's going to shamble out from the shadows for me. So I love your city, but it's so funny because Dragon Con is so packed with people. So then at any other time of the year, it seems very vacant. At any other day other than Dragon Con, because, you know, there's 70,000 people versus, you know, the average, you know, after business hours in Atlanta, it seems so empty comparatively.
That's true. Well, also, now, and I know I've only got a few more minutes left with you, until you do the ghost tour, your ghost tour guide for Burrows of the Dead, New York City.
I am. I'm a ghost tour guide as well. Yeah, see, I love talking about ghosts. I mean, all of my books, The Eternophiles included, they all have ghosts in them, and I love telling ghost stories, so it's a good fit.
Well, let's get to the main points before you have to run and get back to your book.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, your publisher is Tor.
Yes.
And how long have you been with Tor? That is a pretty fabulous...
They're a wonderful house. I've always wanted to be published with them. I started out with a small company called Dorchester Publishing. They were a genre house with their offices on Madison Avenue, and they published mass market paperbacks, and they've been around since the 70s. I got my first contract with them, but then during the financial crisis, they went bankrupt and took the rights and all the royalties that I was owed for my first three books in the Strangely Beautiful saga. And that was a whole trauma. It was really bad. And for lots of authors, myself included, it was really pretty heartbreaking because those books were like my babies. Those were the books of my heart. Those were the books I'd spent 9 years trying to get out in the world. And it was, you know, they'd done very well when they first came out. And so the idea that they were then sort of held hostage was pretty devastating. But Melissa Singer, senior editor at Tor, was familiar with the series. And when her and I met up at a fantasy convention, we got to talking about what had happened with the series, and we started talking about possibly collaborating together, and she basically had thought that I should have been with Tor all along, and I thought so too. And she said, well, your work didn't come onto my desk, so, you know, well, but now we can have a chance to correct that. So she basically is my knight in shining armor and rescued me from the funeral pyre, as it were, and now is giving a second chance with the new series in addition to reissuing Strange and Beautiful. So basically she wanted to bring me on board with doing a new series, similar theme in that I've made a niche in Gaslamp fantasy. I am known in my little corner of the world. I am known for doing gothic gaslight fantasy novels. That is what I've done. I have seven novels out. I have a young adult series, and I have my Strange and Beautiful series, and I have Eternophiles. All of them set in the late 1800s, all of them dealing with ghostly paranormal phenomenon, and all of them are in a parallel world. So you'll see characters from one of the series that will show up in the other series and vice versa.
And you don't have to have read my previous work to jump in with Eternophiles. That's my first book with the new series, and you can jump right in with that. It's a big cast of characters. But if you are familiar with my other work, you're going to see some familiar faces. So for my fans who have stayed with me through these other series, they're very excited to see some of their friends come back, and it's kind of delightful. So I plan on keeping that going as the series continues, and then the Strange and Beautiful series will pick back up. We'll reissue those books, and by 2018, we'll have the fourth and final book in the Strangely Beautiful saga, which is basically Victorian Ghostbusters, essentially. That's basically the easiest way to put it. That fourth book was never released because of the publisher's collapse. So now that Tors has the series, they bought that fourth book that was never released, that everyone was expecting. The title had even been out on Amazon and everything, but the book was never finished because I was never paid for it, and I was reeling with all the other legal stuff with getting the rights back for the first three books. So this has a happy ending now, in that I'm now with, you know, a house that really understands historical fantasy.
Definitely.
They've done such a great job with Mary Robinette Cole's work, dealing with Regency magic. And then they're letting me just have my way with Victorian magic and Victorian, you know, dark Victorian themes. And so I feel definitely very much at home there. And I have the most beautiful cover for Strange and Beautiful, the reissue of that book. I could not have asked for a better cover. It's a gaslit London that I just am over the moon about. It's on the front of my website, and it's just so gorgeous. And I'm really, really thrilled. So it's,
and if
I'm home.
If somebody hasn't seen it, I have the link here on the page, everything on Facebook, every social media where I've shared this, and even on the homepage here on Blog Talk Radio Show from Madame Perry Salon. I've got the link to Liana Renee Heber's website, so you can see it. Absolutely stunning. You can just kind of get lost in there for hours, like you've stumbled into your favorite mansion or something from the past, and learn about her Torch and Arrow, her Etsy store, and her work, and her marvelous books. So what I want you to remember before, because I've kept it too long, is the Eternophiles series, and the Strangely Beautiful Tales, like the Strangely Beautiful Tale of Miss Percy Parker. And some of these are available for pre-order, right?
Yes. The Eternophiles currently is available in hardcover. It's going to be released in mass market paperback in February. So the Eternophiles is now available. You can get the hardcover now. Amazon has it on a pretty good price right now. I think it's significantly reduced on Amazon. You can get it on any of your digital platforms. The mass market paperback, if you prefer that edition, you can pre-order that, and that will come to you in February. And then Strangely Beautiful, I really encourage anyone who likes my work or is interested in my work to please pre-order Strangely Beautiful, because right now the pre-orders are at a significant discounted rate. And for a reissue, the pre-order is like the best thing you could do, because they're going to be determining the print run and how much, you know, support that they're going to put behind this reissue, depending on what the interest is in a pre-order capacity. And for those who think that, oh, well, I read that first book, well, I will assure you that it's better this time, because we're putting books one and two together. So the Strangely Beautiful Tale of Miss Percy Parker and the Darkly Luminous Fight for Persephone Parker, the first two books in the series, are put together in one single volume, and it's been re-edited entirely. I went through everything and cleaned up a couple of little loose ends, things that hadn't gotten caught in the first edition. This is the author-preferred edition, and it has new scenes in it. So my bad girl, Lucille, has a couple of extra scenes that she did not have before, and there's extra content, backstory about why Percy has the last name that she does, and it has to do with a really powerful graveyard experience that I had. That story is in there. A deleted scene is in there, and some other goodies are in there that were not previously available in print. A little short story with two of the side characters is put into that edition. So
this is very exciting.
Yeah, it's very exciting in that it's a whole new edition. So it's not just a reissue. It's a whole revamping. It's a new book because it is better edited, cleaner, And it clips along at a better pace because we took out some of the filler stuff, especially going into the second book. We didn't need to make the recap because we're just going from the first book into the second book, essentially. So,
if you loved it before,
really,
you're going to be
ecstatic. You're going to even more so now. And definitely with the new scenes, it's worth picking up. Not to mention that I've seen the inside in the interior art with the layout and the fonts. It is one of the most beautiful books that I have seen, and I am very, very, very blessed to have, especially for this book, to have a happy ending after the trauma of what happened to the books before. Having everyone's support as these come back out in the world, especially now that things are kind of hot. Like, you know, if you liked Crimson Peak or you were kind of interested in things like Crimson Peak or Penny Dreadful, those kinds of shows, my work's a little more family friendly than those. Those are more straight up horror. My stuff's a lot more, you know, all of my work is PG-13 because I have 9-year-olds and 90-year-olds that read my work. And I want the stuff across my platforms to be on that PG-13 range so that anybody can pick up a book that has my name on it and not be shocked by content one way or another. So, yes, I have dark themes and I have spooky stuff in it, but I really keep to that PG-13 angle. But if the themes of things like and the look of things like Crimson Peak or Penny Dreadful appeals to you, but you want something a little more family-friendly, well, I am your girl for that.
All right. Well, I've got one more. I'll tell you what, I've got an author, poet, and he's the publisher of Subtlety Magazine, David Hurley, one of my favorite people here at Madame Perry Salon. And he didn't know that you have to go yet, so if you don't mind, I've got a comment from him. He messages in his
bring it on.
All right. David Hurley says, she had me at albino-type heroine, Jack the Ripper in Victorian England. So I'd start with your Percy stuff, and I think your summaries and book. And I haven't read this yet, so I'm reading cold here. Your summaries and book covers are compelling, and I see that you also act on top of the million other things you do. So true. no surprise that you filled the role of the beautiful Lucy in a production of Dracula. I'm curious if and how your acting experience and expertise enrich and affect your writing?
That's a great question, and it's one that I come to a lot, and I love talking about, and I actually do workshops about. I teach a workshop about how to use theatrical techniques from the perspective of theater people looking at your work as a writer. So I basically bring theater terms to writing students and say, hey, look at it from these perspectives, and you're going to see your work slightly differently. And for me, it's definitely about character. I invest myself very deeply into my characters and into what they see and what they feel. So I'm a very character-driven author, and I think that has to be because I'm an actor. I also very much need a director, which is why I need a strong editorial presence, because I'm very much a team player with my editor to help shape the book and to really take it that next step. I've got some great ideas and some great characters, but Melissa is really that helped me to shape the work into not getting lost in the character and not going off on too many character tangents, which is one of my you know, everyone has their own little, you know, quirks in writing, and definitely going off on character tangents is one of my guilty tripwires, basically, as a writer. Definitely character and feeling like I want to be in my character's skin. So really feeling like I'm in every way experiencing their sensory life, what they're tasting, seeing, smelling, hearing, and also how they're moving in terms of a period drama, moving in the clothes that they would be moving in, which I have extensive experience in, having dressed in the role, having all of these things where night after night I would have to be in these Victorian costumes, and I would have to do some pretty superhuman things being in two productions of Dracula. One is Mina and one is Lucy, and I was doing all these very physically active things, and I put my characters through physically active things, and they're complaining the whole time about their garments, which I did too. So having to be on stage and working with them. But I think if you're not aware of those kinds of things, you're kind of missing out on an opportunity to put yourself further in the world of your characters by really trying to live in their physical skin as much as you can.
All right. Leon Ray Heber, I know that you have stayed over time with me, so I've got to list you. I've got to send you off so you can finish more work for us.
Well, bless you. Thank you.
And
but
so,
we will do this. We will do this again. You tell me when, and you know, by I'm hoping that I'll have this all done in the next couple of weeks. So I can still come back to you this year yet, if you like.
This year,
so.
Okay. That's pretty good. That's something, okay. Now, you know people are going to be trying to hold me to that. So, all right, folks.
I'm a woman of my word, so don't worry.
Oh, I know that. I have no doubt in my mind. I can testify to that. And Strange and Beautiful Tales, Eternal Files. I've got all the information on all my social media, as well as you go to Leona Renee Heber's website and just enjoy your visit there. Thank you so much, darling. And for everyone still with me, I'm going to go straight to the song Dark Desire by Valentine Wolf. And Leona Renee Heber.
Oh, I love Valentine Wolf. Valentine Wolf
you?
Is awesome. I was on panels with them down at AnacroCon. Atlanta, I'll be at AnacroCon in February, so I will see you all there.
Fabulous. Okay, then we'll see you. Come on down to my town. I'll show you around.
Heck yeah.
Even though you already know it, you'll see my side of it. Yeah, Valentine Wolf, they did some music for James Musgrave's Detective Patrick O'Malley series, too. So that's pretty
fantastic.
World. Now, go get busy. Thank you for being here.
All
we
right.
love you. Now, get out of here and
Thanks,
get to work.
Thanks, love. I appreciate
right.
it. I shall.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Thank you so much.
Leona Renee
Heber. She's fabulous, folks. So don't forget the Eternal Files, Strangely Beautiful Tales. She's off right now finishing things for her publishers so that we can enjoy it later. So listen to Dark Desire by Valentine Wolf. That was Dark Desire by Valentine Wolf. And before that, I was interviewing Leona Renee Heber who's an actress, playwright, author. Her books are now with, formerly with Dorchester, but now she's with Tor. And Tor Publishing House is a perfect place for her, especially for her Gaslamp romances. But now I've shooed her out of the studio because she has a deadline and was very generously giving us some time tonight, but she will be back later on this year, she's going to try to do. And now, who do I happen to have here but the most fabulous BFF of all time and a podcaster herself, Kenya Colbert. Hi, Kenya.
Hello, beautiful. How are you?
Honey, I'm doing fabulous. I'm so nice. So nice to have you just drop in. What are you doing?
I was listening to the interview. Oh, my God. Just know that
I
was
know.
A wonderful interview. It was so fast-paced and filled with energy. And I'm like, wow, this is good.
Well, thank you. Well, you know, I had invited her, and then all of a sudden she had a deadline, and she said, you know, I can either do 30 minutes this time, or we can wait until later and do an hour. And I said, okay. She says, which do you want? And I said, why don't we do 30 minutes now, and then when you've got the new book out, we'll do an hour later. She said, okay, yes. I'll take both.
Yeah.
And this was very generous of her.
Best 30 minutes. Wow.
Well, you know, I told you that, you know, I met Liana Renee Heber at Book Expo, the one 2013, I believe. And
I remember
she had on. Yeah, that black outfit. I think I showed you the picture, had the black outfit on that she's in this montage I've got here on Facebook. And I started taking
that.
Pictures of her. And then I went to a panel that she was speaking at. So that's pretty cool. So then. And
she
then how cool
that,
that
look,
she,
though. Wow.
Oh, yeah, and she said she lives it. She said, you know, growing up in Ohio, and then the first time she read Edgar Allan Poe, she knew, okay, then that's when she felt, okay, at home.
She felt
this
at home. Wow. That was a great interview, Jennifer. Really, you guys covered so much in so little time, with so much enthusiasm and excitement. I'm not even a Penny Dreadful lover. I don't like Penny Dreadful. That's Keith's show. You know, he loves that whole Penny Dreadful
Keith,
thing.
Oh, Keith, yeah. He's the expert. He's our resident expert.
But she made me want to read her books because that's the only thing I don't like about Penny Dreadful is that it's just so over the top. It's just so graphic that I would love the story without all of that. So she really intrigued me enough to make me want to go and read these books because I haven't read her books yet. But after listening to her and just listening to you guys talk about it, I'm all excited. I'm about to go and get me books. Yes.
The first one I read was Darker Still, and
yes.
Like she says, it's a gas lamp with a gas lamp fantasy and romance. And you know what? I got to tell you, I think one of the things that I like about that, and when I watch old shows from back in the 19th century, is that if you were going to have, you know, the rules were so different. The mores or the things that people, you know, that you live by certain rules. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, like now where people just kind of go whatever. There were certain things you did or did not do. Yeah, societally, or you'd ruin your reputation or something, or your family's name. And for people to be able to have some kind of a romance, especially a little secret one or to approach somebody, there were so many intricacies. And you sure didn't have cell phones or things like that.
Exactly, yes.
But you have to slip little messages here and there, and
have other people
sneak.
To pass the word for you, and
a lot of little
innuendos.
It's hard to sneak around in all those big clothes. I'm thinking, you know, if somebody, you know, got around and all that, and then managed to, you know, have some kind of a rendezvous, you'd think they'd have to plan an extra hour probably just to undress and dress, just for all that stuff. I'm just saying, I shouldn't have.
I'm saying you're going to need time just to get close to each other because those dresses are so big with that big hoop skirt in there and all the extra buttons and everything.
Well, have you ever worn anything like that?
I did, but I don't like to talk about it much. My parents were very strict, so when I went to prom, I kind of looked like that. is so sad. It is so sad. But my pictures, I'll have to show you. Actually, I'm going to send you one to where I'm really resembling that a lot. Just imagine all of that and throw a splash of pink, very pink, because I loved pink. But woo, that dress and all those buttons and that skirt and wow, yeah.
See, I've never worn that. Although I had to wear a costume of a British, British girl, maybe a 17th, 18th century pub girl with the big skirt and the waist corset and the top for this thing. As a booking agent, I hired a bunch of us to be like an old British pub type thing for somebody's birthday party. They hired all the people.
Oh, that's cool.
Or actually, back a long time ago when I worked at Steak and Ale, I had to wear something like that too, but it wasn't nearly.
That wasn't quite like
stupid
that.
Stuff, you know?
That's funny. Yeah, those are, I love dressing up anyway, so just an opportunity to just dress up just seems like so much fun. And then for her, and I love David's question because it was great. How well do they fit? They fit so great that it must be really challenging in some ways and liberating in other ways that she can just become her character.
And I'm so glad David had a chance because I don't think he knew that she was only going to be on for 30 minutes, and he was busy. And so for him to get in a comment too, you know, he always adds so much.
Yeah, definitely. And you know I'm crazy about him. And I love his questions.
I love him too. He's got a book coming out soon too, another book. So we'll have to be geared up for that too. Yeah.
Can't wait.
And
Can't wait.
Haven't seen it yet. He's mentioned that I might get an advance look at it, but who knows? He might be just teasing me for all I know. But I don't think he's
teasing
a David. I know you're not. I'm just letting you know that I haven't forgotten about this. And, you know, we ought to do some kind of a play where we're dressed up in costume. Or we could write a play and use all of our little people that we know. You know, like other people's
like
kids.
Like who?
I'm not going to use that one certain word. But, yeah, like other people's kids that we know. Like I've got a friend, friend named Nicole
you,
and Courtney. They're friends of mine. And they, Courtney's got a couple of little boys. Nicole's got a couple of little girls. And they're dear friends of mine.
Yeah.
I'm sure they wouldn't mind me taking their kids and putting them in costumes. I wanted to put
when
Nicole.
When you have kids, you don't care who takes them. You're just happy
to
get a break. So.
Yeah, I think before I was planning a little costume for Amira, Nicole's oldest girl, and fine. But she'll be in a fine, whatever, you know.
Yeah, Amira loves everything that you give her. Trust me, she loves every outfit, every little everything. So the kids always see. Kids just love make believe and pretend, and that's what acting. I mean, that's what I loved about. Just the way that she was talking about, you know, your destiny, the way she was talking about being able to transform and to really live in that moment. She said, I want to smell what they smell. I want to taste what they taste. I'm like, wow, this is good.
Yeah, and like she said, when she was doing the, David Hurley mentioned the Shakespeare she did, Shakespeare Dracula, she's talking about was a very physical role thing to do, plus you have all those clothes on while you're doing it, and so that makes her understand how her characters do. And, you know, she said she comes to Atlanta every year for Dragon Con, and I think she's also going to be at AnacraCon in February, so hopefully you and I can plan to do that. Maybe we can even do a live show there or something.
Well,
want
to, yeah.
Do you?
Great interview, though, Jennifer. I love listening to her. She's so, her energy is crazy. She's like.
Well, you know, you and I both know. Oh, yeah, she's magnificent. But I guess, you know, she's got all these stories in her and just the whole creative thing. And plus her being on Boardwalk Empire for how many years now? How many seasons? And
she's
got, you know.
Six or something,
just this rich life going on. So, Yeah, I think that's pretty cool. I was very fortuitous that I happened to meet her, that I just happened, as big as Book Expo is, and as many people are
there,
that I just happened
that
to cross paths with her. And then she was so, you know, she was so friendly and so kind to me, like, excuse me, can I take your picture at all? Just a lovely woman, very smart.
Oh, I enjoyed just listening to her. And I honestly had planned, and this is so funny because I kept thinking, I felt like with your interview, like I was watching people jump roping and I wanted to be like Double Dutch, jump in. I kept thinking, I'm going to call now.
I know.
But
it's
the
like
energy
I knew.
Was so much fun.
Oh, good. Well, and you only had a certain amount of time, and I definitely wanted people to know about the Strangely Beautiful Tales and also the Eternal Files being out, and that you can pre-order the Strangely Beautiful Tales now, and you get, I think, a discount. I mean, it'll be a, you know, better rate. Plus, she's added so much to the stories, added a little extra
that.
Books in there. Yeah, pretty cool, huh? And
well,
then the fact that she already knew
one.
Valentine. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was just saying that's the book I want. That's what I want because I love that revamped, refurbished and fixed it and corrected all those things that you have. You know, it's sort of like taking an outfit and you love it. And you're like, oh, this is so good today. But you pull it back out 5 years from now, you're going to need to do a little things to spice it up, spruce it up a little bit. And I love that idea.
Mm-hmm. Maybe a little alteration. Maybe a little a little extra something here, a little extra accessorizing, but it's got to all fit.
Yeah.
It's got to bring the sparkle, not just be a cover up. And plus, when I said Valentine Wu, she was already a fan. You know, she knows them from Dragon Con already.
Yes.
What else was I going to say? Yeah, and since I only had so much time with her, you know, I had to rush through it. However, I thought you were going to be at a comedy club tonight, because I thought I was going to be too.
I thought you were going to be at the comedy club and I was going to come and cheer you on, but I never got that magic text. So
we'll get to that another night. But let me
tell
you this.
I hope to see you performing soon.
Oh, thanks, honey, and I hope it makes you laugh in the right way.
Out. You guys have to come with me, meet me there. And we are going to support Jennifer. So you guys, when she gets ready to do this, and once she cuts her teeth and get all settled in, I am going to have a little private party, okay? And I'm going to invite all of you guys. I'm going to invite you. We're going to go and we're going to have a great night at the comedy club and share this moment with Jennifer.
Oh, thanks. That'll be fun. And then, of course, I will have to add a little something special to everybody's drink so they'll think I'm extra funny. Maybe I get some nitrous oxide from the dentist office. Give everybody a little oxygen huff. Just kind of go around, spray everybody one time real quick before they even know what's happened. Hey, also, you know what? Shayna Ochoa, who she wrote the book Stella, about Stella Adler, the famous actress and acting coach. You know, she was going to be on last week, and then was so busy and that she's had to put it off. But, you know, Shayna was kind enough that when I started tweeting this about Liana Renee Heber being on the show tonight, Shayna Ochoa also retweeted that. So I love how authors support other authors. I always say that if you sincerely help someone like that, they'll... Most of the time, I'd say 99% of the time, they will do the same thing for you. And so thanks to Shayna Ochoa. And as soon as I give her some dates, we'll have her back soon to talk about Stella Adler, which is a great book. I met her at Book Expo, too. So
I can't wait to meet her as well. I'm excited, and I love people that share. They have big hearts, and they're not selfish. And there's enough for everybody. So I love that energy that comes from people, and they don't mind showing you what somebody else is at.
Absolutely. Because if you read a book, if you're a reader, you know, it's an addiction that has to be fed all the time so that you can't get enough books.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And
so
we
thank
know because,
you so much.
And, you know, your parents were readers. And so, you know, when you come from readers, you know. Yeah.
Yeah. You know. And you, I mean, and it's just, it takes on a life of its own. So I love that she did that. Good for her.
So now this Friday night.
With no prompting whatsoever. That's great.
Yeah. Yes, she did. That, you know, yeah, that's a good point. You're exactly right. With no prompting whatsoever, I looked down and saw the retweets like, oh, Shayna Ochoa retweeted your tweet. I thought, oh, it's the one about Leon Ray Heber. How cool. Thank you, Shayna Ochoa. We are so excited. I'm going to get you some dates tonight so we can get you back here. Speaking of excitement and Friday nights, Kenya, your show, Everything Relationships, has really started to garner a cult following.
I love this show.
It's like a little party in itself. I mean, last week I went ahead and listened for a while before I even called in because I didn't want you know, you to bring me in while I was listening to somebody, you know, because there's a segment where, you know, you are a professional life coach. Some people know.
Yes, I am.
And as a professional life coach, you also have people who are give people the opportunity to send in questions.
Yes, I do. I welcome those questions. Yeah.
And then you have
not only just the questions, but any situations that you'd really like to talk about, but you don't want to share it with everyone, but you want to share it, but you want everyone's opinion on it, but you don't necessarily want to be the face behind the question. I love the anonymous part of Ask Kenya. I really do, because people are able to just be truthful. And, Jennifer, you know from the show, we get some situations on there, but they are real life. We all have those times, and I love that show. Thank you for mentioning that.
Yeah, and the thing is you've expanded. You have the Ask Kenya section, and then, of course, now you have a sports section.
Sports Nation,
yeah.
Yeah, we got a little competition going.
Yeah, you got that sports, which I think is fun, but I don't know anything about it. I feel like, okay, can I just sit and listen? Because I don't even know what you're talking about, but it's fun. It's fun to listen to that. You know, it's like my friend, you know, Ann Guilfoyle, because she comes from a family that was, you know, big in sports. Her dad was the public relations VP for the Yankees, I believe, New York Yankees and all. So she knows all about sports. And so collect sports memorabilia. All you people that know it and all the little fun rivalries and stuff you have with it, it's like a club.
Totally clueless. Keith is the expert. He is my co-host, Keith Harper. He is my co-host and my partner in crime. And, man, he loves everything sports. So we came up with a way for him to really use his talent. He is like an encyclopedia or something when it comes to sports, everything sports. So everybody enjoys listening to his predictions. He's got weekly predictions, and he's really, really funny in a very I can't remember.
Give me a hint. Little word. Sounds like TV, radio, comedy.
TV comedy comes on every week. The guy who's really straight has this really straight face, but the crew that's with him, you know, you and Keith love that show all the time. I try to catch up.
Oh, Key and Peele?
Not Key and Peele. No, the guy, the one who is very straight.
Straight face, I think of Richard Ayoade from the IT Crowd.
No, he has
Richard Ayoade always has a straight face.
No, I can't remember the name of his face, but Keith is like that. He has the straight face, and his sense of humor is really to the left sometimes. Like, his voice is very, like, calm and never really gets going, and then all of a sudden he'll say, and you're like, what the heck? So he has his own little thing, but yeah, the show is growing unbelievably. Thank you. And we deal with everything relationships, not just dating, not just being married. I take what I do in just coaching, and I open it up to the audience, to the listeners, to really take real-life application, everyday situations, and we talk about them, and we talk about our part in the relationships and the things that we do in life. How do we affect life?
not how does life affect us and what is that result. No. On the show, we talk about our actions. How do we really, really, really set things into motion? And how can we change the things that we don't like? And how can we do more of the things that we do? So we have fun. Thank you. We do. We have fun on there.
Well, good. I'm glad. And I'm so glad that you called, too, with this. So let's see. What else I was going to ask you about? Yeah, so I think that I wanted to make sure that people know when to listen and what time Friday night.
Friday nights, 9 p.m. Eastern time. Go to my Facebook page, and just like Jennifer's page, you can also click onto my link as well. It's a podcast, so I am Kenya, K-I-N-I-A, Colbert, C-O-L-B-E-R-T on Facebook. And on Blog Talk, it's Blog Talk Radio, Kenya, K-I-N-I-A, underscore Colbert. And you can find all of the old shows, the pre-recorded shows that are done, well, the shows that are now recorded, and we do them all live. But those shows are sitting there waiting for you to come and listen so that you can join us live one night. And I love for you guys to call in. So be sure to call in. And if you can't find me there, you can find me here on Jennifer Perry's show.
Yay, that's true.
I have to come and peek in.
Well, you know, I think what I'm going to do is, I don't know, I thought as we go away, I feel like I should close with a song. And I've got two songs that were leftovers from the Halloween shows that I didn't get to play. And one is Cab Calloway, Ghost of Smokey Joe. And, you know, I love Cab Calloway.
Yeah, me too,
Howdy, howdy, ho.
Howdy, howdy, ho.
Minute of mood. And what other was Julie London. Who I love too. Which should I go with? Julie London?
Since
I'll tell you
can
what.
I have that one?
Yeah. Because it's your show is everything relationships, and so is Julie. So before I close, this is Madam Perry saying thank you for listening. Thank you for joining me in Madam Perry Salon. Thank you to Liana Renee Heber, the fabulous best-selling, award-winning best-selling author of Gothic Victorian fantasy novels. Definitely get her Strangely Beautiful series and The Eternal Files. Thank you to Valentine Wolf for giving me Dark Desire to Play. Thank you to BFF Kenya Colbert for coming on and talking about her show, Everything Relationships. I hope to meet up with you guys there because, believe me, it's just like a big house party sometimes, even though we cover serious things, or she covers serious things. And now we're going to close, and soon we will have, hopefully very soon, we'll have Shayna Ochoa on the show, but I'll make sure you have. And thanks to everyone who shared this info. And now, Julie London with This October.
Good night.
Oh, good night.
I'm in the mood for this October. I found an end in summer, man. And that's why I'm in the mood for this October. I plan to love him all I can.
What is more exciting than the crisp, brisk weather in the fall?
It's especially delighting when you got a guy so handsome and so tall. And that's why I'm in the mood for this October. I found an end in summer, man.
You can talk about Maytime and the spring romance,
but even the snowy white December doesn't have a chance.
'Cause I am in the mood for this October.
I caught him in the autumn